Thinking Basketball Podcast. My name is Ben. Welcome back to part two of the Eastern Conference Finals MVPs that we're handing out. This is part four and the final installment of this series where we've gone back to the year 2000, not just with our friend Conan O'Brien, but with the entire NBA to Cody. That's a reference to Conan O'Brien in the year 2000. The people know who used to watch Conan O'Brien 23 or 24 years ago. It's a huge chunk of this audience is big 1990s Conan O'Brien late night fans. We've already gotten off on a good track here today. 2000 to 2021, we've gone back and we've handed out what Cody has affectionately dubbed the Thinking Johnsons. That is the Western Conference Finals MVPs named after Magic Johnson, because the league's only given out one, so we have to go back and fill in all these blanks to sort of square the circle of the universe. And now we're doing the Eastern Conference. Last time we stopped in 2000 to 2010, which leaves us 2011 to 2021, part four. That's what we're going to cover today. And I don't anticipate talking about LeBron James much at all. Do you?
Well, before we start on LeBron train, I need to pause. I need to give a shout out to somebody out there.
A shout out
in the Twitter world. Yes, you're talking about 2000s, and we had this discussion about when decades begin. And I was like, I would like a 10-tweet thread explaining when decades start.
That's right, yeah.
And Twitter user at PaulTree10. I'm not going to fully shout out this person because it's technically only 9 tweets. So, you know, if you miss the buzzer beater, you don't win the game.
Embarrassing.
So yeah. I'm actually kind of disappointed in this person, but they gave it a valiant effort. I don't know if we reward efforts around here, but PaulTree10 gives us a nice little historical look at when decades begin. And if you're into reading that sort of thing, go check it out because it's at least mildly interesting.
So the conclusion was it's okay for us to talk about 2010s as a decade, and if you slip up and you say the 21st century began on January 1st, 2000, that's okay too.
Yeah, that was my takeaway from it.
Okay, so we're in the clear because we didn't even split this part up by decade. We're already in 2011. So we just do whatever we want here.
Well,
it's total chaos.
I think it's better that we don't split this in decades. This feels like eras. There's like, you know, the dead ball era, and then there's the LeBron era. And I think that's kind of how we split this up.
And that's where we're going today, right? I mean, we're foreshadowing just a little bit. I don't want to give away too many spoilers. But LeBron James does make the NBA Finals for 8 consecutive years. So he's going to come up in a few of these series, even if he doesn't win all the Finals MVPs. And at the end, we'll do a recap. The other thing, I think, because there's so many LeBron series, is I feel like we're going to get a little bit more philosophical today than we have in the first three parts. If we had gone back to the 80s, we might have encountered the same thing with Magic Johnson. But let's start in 2011. This is the Heatles, Cody. This is peak Heatles. This is when the band was formed. If you weren't around for it, it was insane. It was a frenzy. LeBron had a television show on ESPN that Bill Simmons pitched in a column idea a month earlier about how incredible it would be for us as fans to have a pay-per-view event where someone announced where they were going in free agency. Free agency wasn't that exciting 15 or 20 years ago. And sure enough, he did. He took his talents to South Beach. He teamed up with Dwayne Wade. Chris Bosh came down from the Great North. Somebody, I think it was Jeff Van Gundy, said they were going to win 75 games or more. It didn't turn out like that, but they make it to the Eastern Conference Finals. They're going against the one seed, the Chicago Bulls, Derrick Rose, the MVP of the league, Tom Thibodeau, his rookie year coaching, coming off of the Celtics run, 2 finals in 3 seasons as the sort of defensive coordinator next to Doc Rivers. Take it away. What are your thoughts on this series?
Well, I was trying to think, in my head, I was trying to rank the best defenses that LeBron faces during this stretch. Because he faces a couple of really strong defenses and a couple of strong defenders. And I don't think there's what's interesting is I don't think any of the Bulls this year were necessarily the best quote-unquote LeBron stopper, foreshadowing for something that's coming up later, the best LeBron stopper for this decade. But as a team, as a system that they use to defend Miami, I was really intrigued by by how they played them. Because even though Miami ends up winning 4-1, I thought the way that the Bulls were able to shut down the paint, especially against the spacing when it was like Joel Anthony, Chris Bosh, pre-shooting threes, Dwayne Wade and LeBron, like whoever was guarding Wade could hug off way off into the paint. There's a lot of times LeBron like drives in and there's four and almost five Bulls players touching the paint to block him off. So ultimately, this is a throwback, grind it down sort of defensive series where the Bulls are able to ice and hedge and switch and do whatever they can to try and bother Miami. But ultimately, the superstar minutes seem to win out in the end.
What's cool about this series is it kind of exists before the boom toward three-point shooting, pace and space, and so it still has some of the old traditional, like, 106 points per 100 possessions is pretty good, depending on the context, but it's also got this kind of, like, defensive, grimy... A lot of the series was played inside 18 or 20 feet, is my recollection, and from some rewatches of some of the games, sampling some of the games, it's like, oh, both teams have a lot of big men out there. They're running a lot of actions at the top of the key or like handoffs inside the 3-point line, just things you wouldn't see today. And then going back to the lead-in that I took us on, the Bulls won the first game of this series at home by 21 points. And the Heat not only won the next four games of the series, but games 3 and 4 back in Miami with a 1-1 split in Chicago were pretty competitive. And then game 5 going back to Chicago, the Bulls, I don't want to say the Bulls were in command, but the Bulls had a lead in the fourth, and Wade and LeBron just went on this crazy flurry at the end of the game to kind of steal the game and go to the NBA Finals. And so it was a pretty competitive series. It was a defensive series. The Heat finished the series with a 103 offensive rating. The Heat only outscored Chicago by 2 points per game in the series. When Wade was on the floor, it was almost a dead even draw. So, you know, it was a competitive series. It was, I should also say on that regard, the Heat were only very minor favorites in the series. They didn't have home court advantage, so that could have played into it. But the Bulls were good. They had Rose. They had Joakim Noah. They had Carlos Boozer. They had Luol Deng. They had this incredible defense. And Wade struggled in the series. I thought that defense and the style of defense they play, where you mentioned ice, that's like pushing the sideline, pick and roll down toward the baseline and just taking away the middle, and just all this Tom Thibodeau stuff, overloading the side. I thought all of that combined with the spacing, you know, Joel Anthony spacing, if you will, it didn't help Wade's penetration game, and it was just a rough series for him. I turned on game 4 this morning in prep, and 2 minutes in, he jumps a passing lane, makes an incredible steal, races down the other end for a huge highlight dunk, and he just completely blew the dunk. And I was like, oh, okay, this is not your series. A minute later, little handoff action. Like I said, they were inside 20 feet around the free throw line. Bosh rolls to the layup. Bosh rolls to the rim. He's open for a layup. Wade throws it right to Carlos Boozer on the other side of the court instead of seeing the layup pass. So it was not his series. And I think if I actually had to pick a second Miami player or a non-LeBron player in this series, it would be Chris Bosh. He had a really good scoring series. He was active defensively. I think he was like 68% true shooting in the series. Cody, my pick here is LeBron James.
Yeah, I think that's the right pick. And that's really interesting you bring up the Wade missed dunk, because I was watching game 3 earlier today, and there's actually a play where Bibby gets in the corner, LeBron hits him in the corner, he drives, Wade cuts in like he's so good at doing, and he blows the dunk there. It's one of those really nice cutting in and just hits it right off the front of the rim. So that's interesting he had a couple of those. But what's also interesting, you talk about they played pretty evenly when Wade was on the court. When LeBron was on the court during the series without Wade, it was about 45 minutes. The Heat were plus 14 during the series. So, you know, the most common lineup with that was Chalmers, Miller, Bosch, Haslam, and LeBron. So we had a little bit more spacing out there. I also think this was kind of an awkward time with the Heatles when there wasn't like a for sure who's the like main driver of the offense. And it seemed like there's a lot more your turn, my turn going on. Even though it felt like there was a lot better offense that was being run when LeBron was given the ball. But it wasn't quite like the keys weren't given to him quite yet.
Well, let's start philosophical discussion number one right away, because I think you've landed on something that jumped out to me when I did Greatest Peaks. I've seen it talked about in other places, and that is that the Heat kind of got better the more they realized and leaned into LeBron ball. And this was something that was in the data for most of his time there, if not all 4 years there. I can't remember off the top of my head. But this series, even in 2011, where you still had a little bit more your turn, my turn, or these guys are 1A, 1B. I mean, in the 2011 finals, the Mavs, Mark Cuban has talked about how they loaded up on LeBron and wanted to take away his strengths. And Wade, you know, did his thing in that series. He was amazing for the first couple of games in that series. So you had more of that at that point in time. And yet you still see stuff in the data like Wade goes to the bench, play more LeBron ball, get a little bit more spacing, and you have tremendous success. And even in the game I watched this morning, second unit time is when that came about. So beginning of the second quarter, LeBron stays in, Wade's on the bench, you have more substitutes on the floor, and right away, boom, pick and roll, pocket pass, and one Chris Bosh, you know, post up, fade away jumper, bam. Like, you can see it even in the first season there.
I think that's what makes a conversation about, you know, how teams can fit together and how players can fit. Because when you think about Wade, like, Wade is, yeah, I don't want to, like, some kind of proclamation about a ranking here, but he's a really good cutter. Like, he's great at finding those seams off ball and getting to the basket. But that just wasn't quite enough to, like, elevate having both of them on the floor offensively as much. I think having them both defensively was a huge boon for the defense, because when you have Wade, you have LeBron, you have Bosh, you have three very strong defensive players that can kind of switch around and fly all over the court. But on offense, that cutting, besides transition, the cutting didn't seem to be enough to rise them to the level of other all-time offenses.
It's interesting. I wrote about this redundancy in Thinking Basketball, the book, years ago, and it still seems to be a controversial idea that we talked about James Harden and Chris Paul in 2018 and all the success they had, even in both years that Chris Paul was in Houston, all the success they had. But the difference between, like, if one of them is out there, things can be very good. And when you put both of them out there, you don't get an equal additive effect, right? And I think that's what was happening with the 2011 Heatles from like a basketball sphere perspective. You know, Jeff Van Gundy has never been one to have horrible predictions or bad takes. He's got great eyes, especially for defense. And there was this impression at the time of like, hey man, if you got both of these guys together, how are you going to stop them? And there's some truth to that. And that, you know, the Celtics the round before, another fairly competitive five-game series that the Heat won, but it was tough to just constantly deal with two of those guys out there, or one goes to the bench and you don't get a break. So all that stuff is true, but it's still hard to find, hey, if Wade has the ball, great value, penetrating, you can play pick and roll, isolation, whatever. When LeBron has the ball, you can do that in spades. It's hard to put those pieces together and reap the full benefits of them, and I think that was still very present in 2011.
And in terms of looking at impact metrics, I think what's interesting is if someone were to go, because you have a database of series going back to 2000 and all of your proprietary stats and whatnot, and if you use your box plus minus and pass rating...
You have it too. It's Patreon, right?
Yeah, it's Patreon. Yes.
Yeah, patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. We've got to teach Cody how to segue right into the promo. We have every playoff series back to 2001 blocked out. That's what he's referring to here.
But what's interesting is when you look at that, LeBron statistically, besides maybe like that 2009 series we talked about last time, it looks like he's better in the late 2010s. When he's with the Cavs again, when he's with the Lakers, he kind of spikes in his efficiency and his box creation and his passer rating and things like that. And part of that might be like those teams are more constructed around his skills, whereas this wasn't quite as much. So it's really hard to capture how good a player is based on this when the team isn't necessarily built around their strengths. Because I think this kind of, I don't want to say held LeBron back from being able to showcase what his full capacity was. I think the same thing happened to Wade, but that was sort of what was going on with them at the time.
Did you consider anyone for the Bulls from this series, or was this kind of a slam dunk for you?
This is a slam dunk.
I mean, it's so funny. We're talking about it. We haven't even like mentioned many LeBron plays in the series or his stats or anything. I mean, I think he was just clearly the best player in the series. I hand tracked this entire series 11 years ago. This was the first time I'd gone back and rewatched any of it. I rewatched any of it for this series. He averaged 26 points per game, 7 assists, 57% true shooting. You know, that defense we alluded to, that defense choked off Derrick Rose, and part of it was this like flying around hedge recover, and you'd have maybe Joel Anthony or Chris Bosh hedge the pick and roll screen really hard. Some big man's jumping into the paint. LeBron might be jumping into the paint. Wade and LeBron are flying around. It was like a chaotic kind of defensive style that honestly probably asked too much of the players and asked them to make rotations from one side of the court that I think one coach I heard call him the impossible rotation that they were being asked to make. But that chaos worked well. LeBron had another good defensive series, I thought, and combined with just, you know, pretty clearly being the best offensive player on the floor. Fun Chris Bosh stat from tracking the series. He did not draw a second defender the entire series in all five games. So this was a finishing kind of occasional isolation. The Bulls are going to give him what he wants. Kind of series from him. And then to put some color on the Rose series, he averaged 23 points a game on 44% true shooting. And he was like, the thing is, he might have been the Bulls' best offensive player. They finished with a 100 offensive rating as a team.
And other players on the Bulls, I think Joakim Noah, just in general, with his defensive presence, the ability to do like the 4-on-3 Draymond Green thing we see a lot. I saw the Bulls pulling that off a lot, where Noah would get the ball, trying to make a decision, really good with passing. Noah's a very excellent passer, hitting players in the corner, bounce passes to Carlos Boozer and things like that. So I think Noah is at least in the conversation too for the Bulls.
So 2011, LeBron James gets the thinking bird here. if we move to 2012,
Discord.
Oh, you have one more. Oh, the Discord vote. That would be a good thing. Yes, yes. If you've been following along with us for the first four parts, which apparently I haven't, this is why Cody's here, because we should check to see what the Discord ended up voting on. We had 24 Discord voters for the Eastern Conference Finals MVP, and Cody, we have a non-unanimous win from LeBron James. We have one vote for Chris Bosh.
Chris Bosh, that's fascinating. Yes.
2012, this time it is the Celtics and the Heat. They had sort of a rivalry thing going at the time. I mean, you could argue that even went back to before the Heatles came together, where you had LeBron being eliminated in Cleveland by Boston multiple times. They were eliminated in 2010 and 2008, and then Dwayne Wade also being eliminated in 2010 by the Celtics. This was a Celtics team that had made two finals in three seasons that we discussed. The Heat actually bounced them in 2011 in the conference semifinals. Here they meet in the conference finals. This is the lockout shortened season, which was, those are always kind of weird. And Miami was a big favorite in this series, and yet it went seven games. The Celtics went up 3-2. It looked incredibly dicey. The pitchforks came out. That's the word I'm looking for. The pitchforks came out after the Celtics went up 3-2, because remember, at this point in time, LeBron has still not won a championship. And I think that was proof back then that he was a choker and kind of a beta-ish basketball player who would never be to paraphrase about a million people on the internet I talked to, would never be a top 10 player. So the Heat come back and win game 6 and game 7. Nothing important of note happened in either of those games, and then they went to the NBA finals.
Yeah, so I think a key thing that hurt the Heat in the series is that Chris Bosh was struggling with an abdominal strain, and I think he only played four of the games here, and he was limited in a couple of other games. But that game six, Ben, I don't know if this is like the prevailing thought, but game six, it's LeBron's most important game of his career, right? The most impressive game of his career.
I have not heard anyone say anything other. I mean, I'm sure there are people who think otherwise, but certainly chronologically, at that point in time, it was the most pivotal game. If it's hard to go back maybe and think about it, but the level of criticism that he had before that game, and it was framed because of LeBron's stature, because of how good he was when he was young, because he wore number 23, because he talked about Michael Jordan, because there is this post-Jordan generation of players and none of them clearly took the torch. I'm sure there's like someone out there who's like, wait, what about Kobe? That's not really how it went down. As good as Kobe was, there was no clear like, oh, this is the second coming. So you had kind of all this cultural stuff that was sitting on LeBron's shoulders, probably. And so therefore, I say that to remind people that this started really young. You know, like even some people criticizing his 2007 finals loss against the Spurs, even though he was 22 years old and had just done amazing things against the Pistons. And there was some little lingering disappointment in 2008 when they lost to the Celtics, even though the Celtics were a much better team and it went seven games. 2009, when he won MVP and they had the best record in the league, getting upset by Orlando was a huge one. It was that first, like, Giannis losing to the Raptors moment that really turns the narrative machine against you. And then in LeBron's case, there was some more to pile on. 2010, he loses to the Celtics in the second round in another series where Cleveland was a massive favorite. That was a six-game series. And in that series, he's blown out in game five at home. And I mean, Cody, do you remember like the next day people showing on loop him chewing his fingernails on the bench during the fourth quarter and talking about how he doesn't care? I'm saying all of this to say there was a mountain and an avalanche of sort of anti-LeBron narratives that were built up. 2011's decision, followed by the quote-unquote disappointing season where they made the NBA Finals, with him really struggling in the NBA Finals, still to this day one of the biggest struggles and certainly statistical struggles for an MVP-level player of that caliber, losing in the Finals, and then you're, here we go again, deja vu, this guy's a loser. Game six in Boston, for the umpteenth year in a row, is going to eliminate him from the playoffs.
Ben, you've seen the original Matrix movie, right?
I am not familiar with, is it a science fiction film?
So what's shocking is that LeBron's arc is pretty similar to Neo's arc in a couple of really interesting ways. And I'll give you an abridged version really quickly here. But when you're talking
wait a second, doesn't Neo have some like biblical roots or something? Isn't there an allegory there?
Just wait a second, Ben.
Okay, this is gonna, I should sit back.
Neo is the one, right? That's the whole point. He's the one. And LeBron, you know, going into the league, I think even in when he was 16 years old on the cover of Slam, he was the chosen one, right? So we already have like a connection there. But when we think about some scenes in the movies, right, like in 2007 when he busts out the performance against the Pistons, that's like Neo for the first time going into bullet time. You start seeing it and you're like, okay, this dude has some potential, but he's not quite ready, right? He loses in the finals against the Spurs, and really, you know, he's not ready. He's not quite there yet. This 2012 series, Neo starts figuring out that he might actually not be the one. It's all a sham. None of it is real. That's what the Oracle is telling him, okay? That might be the case with LeBron. He's just not it. 2012 comes up, and it happens. This is the scene in The Matrix when the agent comes, shoots out the phone that's in the phone booth in the subway, and instead of running, Neo decides to turn and fight. And we cut to Morpheus saying he's beginning to believe. This is LeBron's beginning to believe moment. And no, it's not quite as impressive as later in his career, like 2018 Game 1 against the Warriors when he drops 50. That's like the beginning of Matrix Reloaded when he's taking on like 50 Agent Smiths. We know he can do it. We didn't know he could do it at this point. So literally, Ben, this is also LeBron, like you were saying, his most important and most impressive game of his career.
Have you been hanging out with Reggie Miller? What's happening? What's going on? This is LeBron's Matrix moment. Oh man, that was a lot. Do you want to tell anyone what happened? I mean, what happened? We keep talking about LeBron like everyone knows everything that happened. Basically, he came out in game six with the Celtics, favorites to close out the series, down 3-2, and eviscerated them in the first half. One of the great playoff games in NBA history. Finished with 45 in the game, but he had like 27 or 29 points by halftime. And the ship had basically sailed. Game seven was actually pretty close in this series for a while. Then the Heat were able, it was tied entering the fourth quarter. Heat were able to pull away at the end. LeBron with another big game. We're on 2012. We already did 2011. I was like, man, we are just back in the early Heels days forever. So LeBron James 2012 is also going to get my vote for the thinking bird here.
Yeah, and interestingly, on the Boston side, if I'm not mistaken, I think Rondo had like a 40-point game sometime in this series. Yeah, in game two, Rondo drops 44. Miami ends up winning the game, but Rondo coming out with a huge scoring explosion.
That was playoff Rondo, yeah. And I think he was probably the best Celtic in game seven from what I remember. And this is what's crazy about some of these LeBron series that we're going to look at. It's like if you look at the second best player in the series, I mean, if you want to call it Rondo in this case, there's still a pretty significant drop, certainly statistically, but probably just from the type of player we're talking about. I mean, the Celtics had Rondo in 2012. Garnett was still at the sort of end of his extended prime. I mean, he averaged 19-9 in the series, and his defense was absolutely critical for holding everything together for the Celtics. We talked about Paul Pierce last time. 2012, Paul Pierce still had it, although Paul Pierce has always struggled against LeBron's size and length and strength, and this was yet another series where I thought LeBron's defense was critical in taking Paul Pierce away. Ray Allen, this was kind of the end of the line. He had such tremendous longevity over the course of his career, but this was the first time where I really felt like in 2012, it wasn't, you didn't have still the punch from Allen. You still had it from Garnett. You still had it from Pierce. Rondo had a big series on the Miami side. Dwayne Wade was doing his, you know, my knee is holding up as much as it can, 2012 Dwayne Wade things. And I think all these guys were just a giant rung down from LeBron.
And what's interesting is, unlike the previous series we talked about, they were actually significantly better with both LeBron and Wade on the court. They were something like plus 16, I think, when they were both on. But when it was just one of them on without the other, they were significantly in the negative. So I don't know what it was about their synergy that worked out, but that definitely showed more this series than the Bulls series.
It could, yeah, you know, sometimes there's just noise. Yeah, you get these very small off-court samples in these playoff series. There's one more thing we should mention here about this whole narrative arc, and that is the series before against the Pacers, I think, plays a pretty important role in this story. The reason for that is, you mentioned Chris Bosh's injury. This was kind of around the time where the Heat figured out, maybe we can play Chris Bosh as a stretch five. Maybe we can space the floor with smaller players. And I think that kind of, I mean, it's hard to say it unlocked something because both LeBron and Wade are so good, but it certainly helped propel us forward at the highest level with these finals teams with superstars on the court, with more spaced out lineups, with quote unquote small ball lineups. I mean, it's so funny, Cody. You and I have been rewatching so many old games this summer from different eras, and you'll watch a game from, I don't know, 2008, and some team will have a center. They'll have like Tim Duncan. And then, yes, Tim Duncan, center. They'll have Tim Duncan at center, and then they'll put in like a 6'7" forward that usually plays wing, and the broadcast, like Ime Udoka and Richard Jefferson will be the forwards or something, and the broadcasters will immediately be like, Spurs going small here.
It's like the opposite of 2006 when Miami would run out Alonzo Mourning and Shaq, and no one bats an eye at that.
Yeah. Well, we're going to actually get to some more Twin Towers in a couple years, so those days are certainly not over. We still see similar constructions today because you're just trying to get as much balance or defense on the court as possible with the lineups you can. Anything else we need to cover here before we jump to 2013?
Just the Discord.
Discord. 2012, the Discord vote here, the exact same as the year before. 23 votes for LeBron James. And Dwayne Wade picks up a vote. And if you're curious, it is a different voter deviating this time. It's not the same dissenting opinion. Okay. 2013. This is the first of 17 series between the Miami Heat and the Indiana Pacers. Actually, it's not the first. I just referenced the one in 2012. There's this one in the 2013 Eastern Conference Finals that goes seven games. There's the one the next year that goes six games. I think for me, almost at this point, historically, the most interesting note is that Miami was a huge favorite coming into this series, and that it was way, way closer than anyone would have thought. Plus 4-point differential for the Heat at the end of the series, so it wasn't razor thin in the aggregate. And then some of the games, you know, Miami won game one. Cody, is that the buzzer beater? Game one, right? Yeah, LeBron James with a last second sideline out of bounds play where he catches it, blows by his man, finishes with a nice layup at the bucket for a buzzer beater to take game one. But then the Pacers come back in Miami and it's a close game again and they take game two. Wow, that's eerily reminiscent of 2009, right? With the Cavs and the Magic in the first two home games with the underdog. The Magic win one. LeBron hits a buzzer beater to make it 1-1. The difference this time is they go back to Indiana and the Heat crush them in game three. They win by 18, but the Pacers still fight. They take game four. Heat win game five, and they win game seven comfortably, although the Pacers force the seventh game at home. So it's like it's a pretty close competitive series, but I didn't feel like that Miami was really, really, really on the edge. But still, nonetheless, this was, you know, just a great Pacer defensive team led by, I think he's still around playing great basketball, Roy Hibbert, Paul George, who was just amazing defensively. Yeah. Thoughts on this?
Yeah, I know that the Roy Hibbert clowning is super easy because what, it's like 2-3 years later and he's essentially out of the league. He doesn't exist.
It's somewhat unprecedented. You know, I think like the closest connection I can draw maybe is someone like Mark Eaton, but he just gets older, right? He just gets older, and Mark Eaton was like 7'4" and 300 pounds and he was an enormous body. And as the game, you know, they use the three a little bit more, you get a little bit more athletes. But it wasn't a huge strategic shift in the 90s that pushed him out. It was just like he got continuously older and even slower on top of his normal slowness. Whereas in Hibbert's case, he was so good as a rim protector. Obviously, so many people writing articles about his verticality technique when guys come down the lane. He averaged 22 points per game in this series and 10. Let me just say that again. Roy Hibbert was the leading scorer for the Pacers in this series at 22 points per game, 10 boards. And then just like, you know, in a couple years, that archetype and his lack of agility, he's 26 years old here and he's out of the league.
Yeah, the key difference between,
essentially, yeah,
the key difference between him and someone like Mark Eaton is if Mark Eaton even sniffed 22 points in a game, like that would be worthy of a celebration. Like he was limited offensively. But I think that's the thing that stands out when you watch the series is not just the box score, but Hibbert is massive. And the Heat, especially when they try the small ball, like he gets those 22 points because they're trying to run these smaller bigs against them. And he's just enormous and he has a nice little hook shot. He can stretch out his jumper to maybe 15, 16 feet. I think there was a big thing that was made of like LeBron was like, I've been working on a floater for about a week now. And I don't remember which game it was. I think it was game two. He comes out and the first shot he takes is it's honestly a pretty awkward looking floater. He like drives into the paint and throws it up and like curls up into a ball on the way down, but he hits it over Hibbert. And the storyline was just like, oh, LeBron just going in there, he's able to learn a skill in like a week. It's like, all right, I'm sure LeBron's been practicing floaters his entire life. But I remember that was like a weird key element to the series.
Yeah, he had the floater a couple years earlier, and one thing about that mismatch where if you go small and you can get Hibbert offensive rebounds and points, this came up as I was working on the recent Evolution of the Rules video where just in the old days, guys didn't really flop as much when you had a size mismatch. So you genuinely had these battles of strength when you would have a switch or when you would have a quote-unquote mouse in the house having a small guy on a big guy, and that would either lead to offensive rebounds or you could just, even if the player wasn't super skilled as a post player, you could still dump it into him and have him turn and power in for like fouls or little 5 foot, 2 foot, you know, shots off the glass, dunks, things like that. That's something that's kind of gone away as more, well, one, teams are guarding the post differently because they're fronting and then bringing backside help. But two, I feel like now, you know, the thing in my head that keeps me up at night, Cody, is if Shaq was switched on to Kyle Lowry or Kyle Lowry was switched on to Shaq in the post and for like you couldn't be maybe as physical back in the old days, but in the 80s and the 90s and the 2000s and still in the 2010s, that would just be an automatic dunk. There would be nothing Kyle Lowry can do. I'm concerned today that if that happened, it would be under 1 second before Kyle Lowry fell down. And whether it was a call or not, there's probably going to be a call. But whether it was a call or not didn't matter. Like, he's going down the second Shaq touches him because that's the technique now.
I think I'm thinking about the Shaq back down against Mutombo where he literally lifts him off the ground. If we combine that with Lowry accentuating the contact, how many rows back is he sliding?
He would be in the third or fourth row, I think. Yeah, I don't know. I don't even think it would be a sliding. I think it would be like something from The Matrix that you were alluding to. He would look like an Agent Smith CGI'd flying up into the stands. Let's get back on track. I've alluded to this series before. These are all like plus 10, plus 11. This series is plus 12. His basketball reference box plus minus average per game. In our model, he's plus 9. His augmented plus minus numbers are huge. He leads the series in scoring at 29 points per game. The 2012 Eastern Conference Finals MVP that we just gave him, he averaged 34 points per game in that series. So once again, in terms of the drama of handing out the thinking bird, I don't know if there's anyone who's really close to second place here, because the Pacers were a very egalitarian five-man unit. I know Paul George, for many people, myself included, clearly the best player, but even the way they structure the lineups, like I've talked about this a few times, there was like starters, and then like a hockey shift. You have the bench in and they would get killed and then put the starters back in. So they were a very balanced team. And this is 2013 Eastern Finals MVP LeBron James all the way for me.
Yeah, and speaking about Paul George, I think what people do sometimes is when they think about Paul George, and I think even his teammate Kawhi Leonard, people think like this, they take like the best of what they see of Paul George now and combine it with the best of his defense that you saw then. And you're like, wow, Paul George might be like one of the best all-time players. But like those two things didn't hit at the same time. He's still a very good defensive player, but peak Paul George, like around this time without the offensive load, like this guy was huge. He was athletic. He was pick dodging. He was nuts defensively.
Yeah. The guy's like 6'8 or 6'9. I mean, this is one of the best wing defensive peaks, I think, this sort of non big man category of defensive peaks. It was monstrously impressive. Might be worth a deep dive to go back and revisit that with some fresh eyes years later, but it really impressed me at the time. And to your point, he was a good offensive player then, but it didn't nearly overlap with what we've seen in the ensuing seasons and even in the last few seasons still. 2014, our last the Discord. Mm-hmm. The Discord. Cody's giving me the Discord finger. The Discord results here for 2013. This one, Cody, we have a LeBron James unanimous win.
Hey.
24 votes, no one else receiving votes.
Okay, good. Now we can move on.
That was for 2013. Sorry. We're going to 2014. 2014, this is the last go around. This is a rematch against the Pacers. And here's the thing. I know it doesn't make for the best content, but I've watched a lot of this stuff in the last 24 months. The 2012 series, the 2013 series, and the 2014 series, they've all blended together. I can't keep them apart. Do we have new stuff to say about this? Is this the same series? They just forgot to play a seventh game.
So here's what's interesting. I found one statistical thing that I was like, oh, that's fascinating. The pace of this series, the pace for the Heat against the Pacers. The Pacers paced them at 83.5 possessions per 48 minutes. Now, if you want some context, the famous 2004 Pacers-Pistons series we talked about last time was at an 82.8 possessions per 48. So this was a glacially slow series. And I know a lot of these series, like the Bulls series, the other Pacers series, they're kind of flirting around the 84-85, but this was the slowest by-possession series of these Eastern Conference Finals. And I found that interesting.
Well, I think you just wanted to say the Pacers' pace. Of course, they are named after the pace car in Indianapolis. But this series is new for us here in part four, because this is the first series LeBron doesn't lead the series in scoring. Paul George leads this series in scoring at 24 points per game. Paul George in the series, 38% from downtown, 24 points, 5 boards, 4 assists, 2 steals, and he finishes at 58% true shooting. LeBron, 23 points per game in the series, 6 boards, only 6 assists, 2 steals, and LeBron's at 64% true shooting. 2014 LeBron was like hyper efficient. This is like LeBron's version of Wilt Chamberlain becoming obsessed with leading the league in field goal percentage. Instead of having it be a gimmick or something like that, it was this hyper selectivity. He talked about it at the time, just trying to be as efficient as possible. You know, short mid-range stuff, bank shots, post games, shot selection was dialed in. So his volume in some of these series, I think in the finals he had the same phenomenon. His volume was down, but he was incredibly efficient. But I don't know, Cody, did you I mean, when you reviewed this, were you thinking someone else for MVP, or are you still leaning LeBron?
Well, there's the one key play that we need to talk about from this series. Probably the most important play that we'll probably ever talk about on this.
What, pray tell, are you alluding to?
Mr. Lance Stephenson, in Game 5 of this series, went to great lengths to stop LeBron, and in one stoppage of play, decided to lean over and blow in the man's ear in a very, very famous moment.
The thing is, the Pacers won that game. They were down 3-1, and they won that game. And are you ready? Are you sitting down? Because LeBron had his ear whispered in, right? There was some blowing in the ear. This game, LeBron James scored 7 points.
I mean, you can't tell me that it's not Lance Stephenson getting in his head.
No, that's what I'm saying. 7 points, 3 turnovers, 5 personal fouls, 2 for 10 from the floor. I got to say that's got to be 90 to 100% because of the blowage in the ear. We're going to move off this immediately because the language construction could get dicey. Paul George, 37 in this game against elimination. This is why he calls himself Playoff P, because he actually does have a number of moments throughout these. We encountered one last 2 episodes ago in the Western Conference Finals where these big elimination games. But alas, it was all for naught because they went back to Miami and they got trounced. Absolutely stomped into the ground. It was 60-34 at halftime in Game 6. That was all she wrote. George had another good game, 29 points. He shot pretty well. And for the Heat, LeBron finished with 8 for 12 from the floor, 25 points for LeBron. I don't know. Can you mount an argument for Paul George as the best player in this series?
I mean, you can. I won't agree with it, but I'm sure someone could construct something. I don't know. I feel like LeBron, again, just domination across the board. Paul George never, like, his assist numbers are up, and I know LeBron's assist numbers aren't quite what they usually are, but his playmaking is still on another level from what Paul George does. I don't know. I think it has to be LeBron again.
What about Dwayne Wade? LeBron did lead the series in box plus minus at plus 9.3 in our model. Wade was second at 6-4. An interesting question is whether this was LeBron's weakest conference finals performance. What was his weakest conference finals performance? I don't know if I'd quite go there. So I guess with all that said, it's still a LeBron MVP series for me.
Yeah, I think that's the right decision overall. And like, to your point about mixing all of the series together here, at one point, Paul George has the game where he sends him to overtime with a 3. At another point, he baptizes Chris Anderson
the dunk.
On a dunk. Yeah. I have no idea when any of these happened. Not a clue. If you asked me for $1 million, I couldn't do it with any amount of confidence.
I could give you a range. 2015. Now, finally, we have some new blood. We have a changing of the guard. Cody's saying I have to do the Discord. Look, if you want to see how trippy this is, the Discord vote is exactly the same, 24 votes for LeBron as it was. No one can keep track of these series. The Pacers fans can't keep track of this series. If you're in Indianapolis, tweet us and let us know if you can remember any difference between you. They probably can't when it's your home team. You can probably figure it out. 2015, LeBron goes to the Cavs. And I actually think this might be his weakest conference finals. I think statistically, it certainly has an argument. I was trying to rewatch a little of it. This is the series against the Hawks. This is the four All-Star Hawks, but this is a weird series because Kyle Korver gets injured in Game 2 of the series. He hurts his ankle, and so you don't actually have the four All-Star Hawks, but he gets injured in a game that the Cavs win by 12 to go up 2-0 on the road going back home, so that's also not very good. Cleveland takes this in a sweep. They outscore him by 13 points per game. They have a 114 offensive rating. And oh, I mentioned Kyle Korver being injured, but Kevin Love was out of this series with the shoulder. And I think Kyrie Irving missed two games in the series as well. He had a number of ailments. This is a first time ever for him. He had like a knee tendonitis, I think, and maybe an ankle or a wrist. I don't know. He had like a wrap on his wrist in one of the games I was watching. So it's a weird series in that the Cavs completely blow them off the face of the earth. But both teams aren't entirely healthy. LeBron finishes with a cool 30 points, 11 rebounds, 9 assists, 2 steals per game. But he couldn't throw it in the ocean, Cody. He was 5 for 20 of 3. He struggled with the 3-point shot in the playoffs that season in general. 51% true shooting from LeBron, barely cracking the Mendoza line there. And I don't want to say this is like my least favorite version of the prime LeBron iterations, but I thought he was heavier. I thought he was a little slower. I thought that weight gain played a difference on both ends of the court. And, you know, he's still fantastic out there. He's still just kind of dominating when you watch here, or his ability to control the tempo in the finals in the next series. But I think if I had to pick one, this might be the one that I slot in last place, maybe. Maybe it would be probably between this and 2011.
I actually want to ask you about this, because it's not just this series. Because if you go through your database and you rank all of LeBron's series by his efficiency, this is his fifth least efficient series of his career. But you know what's crazy about that? He has two other 2015 series that are less efficient than this series. And all four of his 2015 series are in the top 8 least efficient series of his playoff career. So I tried to look into this. I found a Reddit thread that was actually less than helpful answering this question. So I thought I'd come here and ask you, Ben, what was going on with LeBron? Was it a lingering back injury that I saw? Was it the fact that his two main offensive partners were out? Like, was it the fact that he was carrying more weight? What was going on with LeBron?
For me, I think it's the weight, and then I don't think he had his shot completely dialed in from the outside. You know, if you remember sort of the progression of his shot, when you take a step back, you see a steady progression of his outside accuracy over the years. But, you know, 2012, he came back, he added a little bit more of a post-up game, and then also he was able to, at low volume, hit the three with a little bit more consistency. His form was a little different than it was in 2011, 2010, 2009. So just because that consistency creeped in at that point in his career didn't necessarily mean he had it dialed in all the time. And I think as an athlete, when you carry a little bit more weight, or you have a lingering thing or something, or your mechanics, you know, he's not Steph Curry out there. He's not a natural, incredible outside shooter. I think that can lend itself to slumps or kind of periods where you go through struggles. The shot just didn't feel great. I mean, he's still making open threes. He's still hitting spinning fadeaway, you know, post-ups at the end of the clock. But it just didn't have the same sort of consistency that it would. And I thought, especially at that point in time in the NBA where you start to have spacing open up, you start to get smaller lineups, I just thought his kind of losing a little weight and getting a little more of that speed back. You know, there's one play in this series against the Hawks. I mean, I'm sure there's plenty, but there's one I saw recently where he gets that turnover and gets that burst off ball out in transition, and someone hits the hit ahead, and he's like still the fastest guy in the court, but I feel like, you know, 2016 LeBron even would have rocketed past any defenders, and he just didn't have that, because that's what happens when you're carrying like 270 pounds, and his legs looked enormous in some of those games, but he did not skip leg day in 2015. So I don't know, that would be my explanation or my take, but sometimes, you know, who knows?
Yeah, and I think that was
sports.
That was an interesting transition, because at the 2013-2014 seasons with Miami, I think he more seamlessly transitioned to being their four. Like, Chris Bosh is starting at the five, LeBron is more of their four. But when he went back to Cleveland, I thought the idea was that he was going to shift down to a three. But I don't think he committed to, like, I'm going to slim down and be a wing player more until the 2016 series. So he was almost like carrying the bully ball four spot, like post-Karl Malone LeBron body into this, and still not exactly figuring out how he was going to play that. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, because I think in conjunction with that, you had, with especially with Kyrie missing two games, with Kevin Love out, you really had what you would start to think about or see more in the second Cleveland stint, which is he's just commanding the ball, playing Magic Johnson type point guard. I think when you ask people about 2015, the lingering impression is the tempo and the way he controlled the pace against Golden State and things like that. And to your point, that's like a mismatch with the body and the style that he had played with often in Miami. He's so similar, yet you change the role slightly and maybe it starts to feel different. That's kind of my take on 2015. With that said, LeBron James, 2015 Eastern Conference Finals MVP. I'm not sure anyone else is a close second.
Did the Discord feel the same way? Because that's exactly how I feel.
The Discord has this as... Wait a second. I feel like we're getting trolled. Mm. Someone gave J.R. Smith a vote. Oh, I see why. Okay. He had all those threes. This was the series where J.R. Smith, 16 of 34 from downtown, averaged 18 points. J.R. Finn.
Don't give them an okay for that. No, absolutely not, Ben. That's disgusting. I'm ashamed.
Can we move on to 2016?
Please.
Okay. 2016, this is the Cavs against the Toronto Raptors. Cody, admitting this is not good for business, but I was just doing some stuff at the end of last season on DeMar DeRozan, and I watched all these Cavs-Raptors series, and now I can't sort out 2017 and 2016, and there was a 2018 as well. This one was more This was a six-game series. The Cavs, of course, go on and win this series in six. Margin of victory. I mean, it's six-game series, Cody, but the margin of victory was plus 16 for Cleveland. They won the last two games. This doesn't even make any sense. They won game five by 38 points, and they won game six in Toronto by 26 points. And I'm pretty sure in the process, LeBron baptized the entire province of Ontario. I think he took their soul.
I think what's really interesting, the thread that carries from 2015 to 2016, is in 2015, we have the emergence of a LeBron stopper, Ben. We have Damari Carroll on the Hawks. The one Hawk.
Say what? Say who?
Damari Carroll. The only Hawk, I believe, that was a starter that also wasn't an all-star that season. In 2016,
Wait a second. Go back. Did you say LeBron stopper?
Oh, you heard me. LeBron stopper, Damari Carroll.
They may want to rethink that. All right, keep going.
In 2016, Damari Carroll, yes, the LeBron stopper, is on the Raptors. And you think I'm joking, but go Google Damari Carroll, LeBron stopper. And here, I don't know what your Google algorithm's going to give you, but my second article was, is Damari Carroll the LeBron stopper for the Hawks? My third article, is Damari Carroll the LeBron stopper for the Raptors? But then article number one was, we should probably stop saying the LeBron stopper. But I at least found this interesting because he's at least in a long line of these wing players that are quote-unquote superstar stoppers that, Ben, once you get to the playoffs, like Gerald Wilkins, he's not doing anything against Michael Jordan. Rajah Bell, not doing anything against Kobe Bryant. And it's a fascinating lineage.
Yeah, Ruben Patterson for the Portland Trailblazers was the Kobe Bryant stopper. I feel like every time the stopper thing comes up, Cody, one, the real stoppers are big men, who the Rudy Goberts of the world, the Dikembe Mutombos of the world. They're the ones who control and patrol the high leverage, high value areas and make it really hard for perimeter players to actually get to the line a lot or have a bunch of layups and easy stuff like that. And so I always feel like that's a mislabeled term. It's a funny term. It's very rare. I mean, we could try to think of one, but it's very rare, I think, in NBA history for perimeter players to just actually shut down other perimeter players, despite the reputation. That's not how basketball at the highest level works. And I'm not even sure off the top of my head if there's an instance of, there are instances of defensive players having success, like Ryan Bowen came in and guarded Dirk Nowitzki, Bruce Bowen guarding Dirk Nowitzki. But, you know, those guys have bigs behind them. And it's a team effort against superstars. And you really need those bigs and shot blockers in the old days back behind in the paint. And so you look at that and you're like, hey, this guy really shut him down. And then you go look at the numbers and it's like, yeah, he had a bad series. It's 20 points per game. And how much of that came from the perimeter player and how much of that came from having a big behind him, because I'm not sure I can think of a series, at least off the top of my head, where that happens without a critical big man. So I am anti-stopper. How about that?
Well, here, let me give you a follow-up stat for this, because I found this really fascinating. LeBron did not have the game high in points in any game this series. None.
That is kind of cool. He led. So that's a great segue to the fact that he led the series in scoring at 26 points per game. But this is the first series, I think, where at least in that classic box score style, you've got DeRozan at 23 a night, 56% true shooting. Kyle Lowry, 20 a night, 58% true shooting. Kyrie Irving for the Cavs, 24 a night, 56% true shooting. And LeBron at 26 points per game in this series without leading a single game in the series. That's just obviously a sign of consistency. But Cody, LeBron, 67% true shooting in this series.
That's good.
He led the series in oh my goodness, his box plus minus from Basketball Reference at plus 13.9. This was the one I was alluding to earlier. That ties Steph Curry in 2015 for the best single series we're going to discuss since 2000 in all four episodes we've done. In our model, plus 10.8, that matches his 2009 Eastern Conference Finals as the best single series of any conference finals we've talked about. So this is just a monster statistical series, and I think I'm going to have to go LeBron James as MVP of this series.
Not Damari Carroll this time. We're not doing that.
I'm going to beat you to it. The Discord has LeBron in a unanimous vote.
Good.
How many in a row has he won? We're just losing track. So this is ridiculous.
He's got 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16.
To go with 9 and 7?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So let's jump to 2017. I'm very excited about this because for the first time, someone else, at least in Basketball Reference's model, leads the series in box plus minus. That is Kevin Love. This is the 2017 Eastern Conference Finals where the Celtics take on the Cavs and lose in five games. Is that the Isaiah Thomas Celtics?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this was another close one, Cody. Cavaliers' margin of victory in this series was only 20 points per game. They won game five to close it out in Boston by 33, fitting for him to pick up a thinking bird in Boston with a 33-point victory. LeBron again leads the series in scoring, 30 points per game, 7 assists, 6 rebounds, 2 steals, 1 block, 65% true shooting. But Kyrie Irving comes in at 26 points per game on 76% true shooting, and Kevin Love made 23 three-pointers in 5 games, shot over 50% from the 3-point line. He averaged 23 a night on 76% true shooting. So maybe we are in line here for someone else to pick up an Eastern Conference MVP.
There are a lot of wild offensive stats from this series. Just an unbelievable showcase. So our old friend Scorval, which again is, you know, how many points per 100 possessions are you getting off your scoring value? Kyrie has a 6.5 Scorval, which I'm pretty sure in your database is tied for 6th.
That's huge.
Yeah, out of basically the 4,100 series that you have, a 6.5 score val. So that was unbelievable. Now the Cavs, this is unbelievable. 5 players for the Cavs played over 100 minutes in this series, and LeBron had the lowest true shooting percentage of them with 64.5. So the lowest true shooting percentage of the 5 Cav players that played over 100 minutes all had over a plus 10 relative true shooting percentage. This is a bloodbath, Ben. This is a bloodbath. When LeBron, Kyrie, and Love were on the court together for 139 minutes, they had an offensive rating of 141 and a net rating of 37.5.
Did you say 141?
141.
Yeah. LeBron by himself in the 193 minutes he played in the series, the Cavs had a 134 offensive rating. And this is my favorite. when LeBron was on the court, they were plus 29. They were plus 29. Plus 29. And you're thinking, boy, that's amazing. Kevin Love I mean, possibly conference finals MVP, Kevin Love, when he was on the floor, the Cavs were plus 34 per 100. So this stuff's just ridiculous. Does this even count? Is this real?
So I think this was really tough to gauge. It's tough to gauge how good LeBron is and how good this 2017 Cavs team is, because I'm pretty sure that their relative offensive rating is about double in this playoff run than their regular season relative offensive rating. It goes from, like, off the top of my head, it's somewhere about like a 5 to like a plus 10 then. But the level of the caliber of opponents that they're playing in the East at this point, like this Celtics team, Ben, this is just a weak team to make it to the conference finals at this point. So I don't know. How do you judge how good this team and this LeBron are when it comes to the really weak competition they were playing and just how much better they were? Because I think they were better than the regular season numbers say, but I also don't think they're nearly as good as their bloated postseason numbers say. What do you think?
I love that you brought this up. One, when you look at relative rating in the postseason, it's just a snapshot. It's just a particular perspective. And I think sometimes people can get a little bit too dogmatic about it. I think it's hard to evaluate and look at one number and say, how do we evaluate a playoff offense? And one of the reasons is the linearity of it can break down. So you're saying, like, if this team was a little bit better defensively, in this case, the Celtics, the year before the Raptors, then let's say they were 3 points better, and instead of being like the 15th best defense in the NBA or something, they were the third best defense. Then you'd look at that and you'd go, oh, this is a relative offensive rating in that series that's plus 10 instead of plus 7. But the thing that breaks down for me is when you get in a situation in the playoffs, especially the modern game, where you have a huge advantage over a weak defense in the postseason with the tactics and the analytics and minutes ramped up and the breaks between games, it can be very hard to figure out a way to stop it. And so it's kind of like the dam bursts and you get these matchups and you see, like, well, they just crushed that team. They just beat that team by 25 points a game. And if that's your only opponent, and then you mix that in occasionally with like a good team like the Warriors in the finals, you still end up with these huge, huge, huge numbers. And I just have a hard time taking them at face value. With that said, I'm with you in that I think all these indicators, and you watch them play, like, they are an offensive machine. So they're very good offensively. But I think the truth probably, like, where would I stack them up historically? Or if they played in the West, what would it look like? I think you would probably see something in between the regular season and the playoff numbers that isn't this crazy. Just to put some additional context on it, the Celtics that year had a plus 2 SRS, which is just margin of victory adjusted for strength of schedule. This is the type of team typically you'd see, like, if you're in a healthy Western Conference in the 2000s or something, that's a first round exit. That could be a 7 seed, that could be an 8 seed. That's the team they played in the conference finals. The Raptors, 51 win team, plus 3.7 SRS. Same thing. That's like a first or second round team. You know, the Raptors were 11th in defense that season. The Celtics were 13th in defense that season. The Pacers were their first round opponent. The Pacers were 16th in defense. That Pacers team had a negative SRS. So that's the single year part. I don't know if you have any other thoughts on that, but I think what's crazy about this is you get this for multiple seasons in a lot of these Eastern Conference runs. Magic Johnson had it back in the 80s with the Lakers. That's the first time I've really seen it discussed historically and talked about, where it's easier to play in the finals when you are basically continuously beating 8 seeds and then taking a rest and preparing for the series. The Celtics in the 80s had these wars with, like, the 76ers and then the Pistons and sometimes the Hawks or whatever it was. And meanwhile, the Lakers were, like, on the beach getting loose and ready because they had just steamrolled some, you know, 43 win quality team or something. So I think that's part of what's going on here, is that just repeatedly in these years being able to play and beat up weaker competition that doesn't have any counters available. And normally you'd move on to another round where you play a title level team, but that never happened in the East.
And shout out to the 80s Bucks for also being part of that war. I just need to make sure I got that one in there. But when we go back to this series, like, we were talking about the context that LeBron was in, especially with the Heat. This offensive context, like, this is like LeBron ball. And while these other, his teammates, Kevin Love, Kyrie, are having these absurd scoring series, I still just feel like it's LeBron. Because it's just like, LeBron is the engine around which this offense is going. And like, these guys can crush it so well from deep and have all this space and get open looks because this is LeBron at his like apex context creating for these guys. So I don't know, Ben. To me, it still feels like LeBron.
It's LeBron in the landslide. It's a unanimous vote on the Discord, and that takes us to 2018, the final run in Cleveland. This time it's a rematch against the Celtics, but it's a slightly different Celtics team. This is Kyrie Irving's first year, but he's out. So you have Terry Rozier kind of having his scary Terry playoff moments. Jason Tatum is a rookie. Jaylen Brown, even though it's his age 21 season, you know, he jumps in, and specifically in this Eastern Conference Finals series that went seven games, he led the Celtics in scoring at 20 points per game. So very different team, more defensively oriented, and LeBron was still just, Celtics went up 3-2, LeBron, game six, back in Cleveland with a 124 offensive rating. And LeBron's stat line in the game, 46 points, 11 rebounds, 9 assists. He plays 46 minutes, 61% true shooting. That was an absolute offensive masterclass to hold on in game six. And then come back and he drops 35 points, 15 rebounds, 9 assists in game seven.
So I think this is a fun statistical thing that I pulled from StatMuse. Ben, when we look at the games in a series, game one, game two, game three, all the way to game seven, which game do you think that LeBron, as a player, has his worst winning percentage in?
Worst winning percentage?
Yes. Which game does he lose the most out of a seven-game series?
Man, I would guess game one.
Yeah, and it's by a pretty solid margin. He only has a 58% win percentage in game ones. And I feel like that was always the common thread, is like LeBron is just kind of like soaking it in, putting it into his brain, figuring out what he's going to do to come out and win the next couple days. Like, he's always processing right away. And it shows, because in game two, he has a 74% win percentage. But Ben, that's not the game where he has the highest win percentage. Ben, which game do you think he has the highest win percentage of all of those?
I'll go with seven.
It is. That's exactly. Look at you, Ben. Look at you. He's won 75% of his game seven. So he wins 58% of game ones, wins 75% of game sevens. I found that to be really interesting. But when we're thinking about a LeBron scouting report, I don't know how you feel. This feels like, in a single series, this feels like apex offensive LeBron. This feels like, whereas he had a bunch of the tools earlier on, Miami obviously was hyper efficient, he could pass. At this point, he felt a little scheme proof. It felt like no matter what you threw at him, like, got a smaller guy on him, he's taking him to the post. You got to put a bigger guy in him, he's blowing by. You throw out a defensive coverage, he's got to figure it out, and he's going to find the seams and get open shooters or open layups or things like this. That was just what stood out to me when I was watching the series again. It's just LeBron is just transcendent offensively.
If you're a Raptors fan, do you think you've been furiously fast-forwarding for 2019? And if you've landed here, you're still very disappointed. This is the series. This is the second time he did it in 2013. This is the third series that we've seen in the East where someone has swept most of our major categories. That is Basketball References, Box Plus Minus Model, Hours, Augmented Plus Minus, Points Per Game, Score Value, Play Value. LeBron James took all six of them in this series, as well as 2013 and 2007. Remember, the only other players to do that in this century, Steph Curry and Kobe Bryant. In this case, LeBron averages 34 points per game in the series. I don't know if 2017 is his offensive peak or 2018. I don't make me pick one, but I think just in terms of the effect you're describing, the control on the game, the decision making, the way his shot looked and felt, take you to the post, play on the outside, pick and roll, still had the transition juice. Like it was an absolute masterclass. And of course, we saw that carry over into the finals in game one, where, you know, J.R. Smith had, there was some, I don't know what happened there, but this was absolutely incredible offense.
Yeah, I don't want to linger on that too long, because I just feel like for the poor Raptors fan that just fast forward an hour and 10 minutes into this, and they're like, oh, they're still talking about LeBron?
No, it's time. It's time. I'm going LeBron. I don't think there's anyone here close.
No.
You know, remember Kyrie is not on this team anymore. This is LeBron James for me, 2018 Eastern Conference Finals MVP for the Cavs. I mean, here's a cool stat. The Cavs' second leading scorer in the series was Kevin Love at 12.5 points per game. And you're just not going to sell me on Kevin Love or 31-year-old George Hill or Jeff Green or Kyle Korver as having defensive and playmaking impact that even gets into the same universe as the offense we're discussing. So
what about the I'm sorry. I had an internet connection for a second. I thought you were done talking, and I think I just jumped right into your speech. So finish.
Oh, no. You timed it perfectly. What about I was waiting with bated breath.
Oh, perfect. Okay, so the Celtics, if you had to pick a Celtic then to win this series, do you go with rookie Tatum? Is this a tougher question because they were a little bit more egalitarian? Like, who do you think the Celtics would have put up as their best candidate?
Yeah, I think I would have gone with Tatum.
Okay.
For my impression of the series, probably Tatum. You know, I don't know if you can make an argument for Al Horford at that point in time because of the defense, but one of those two guys. Let's give the Raptors fans what they want. Let's move on to 2019. LeBron has packed his bags. He's gone to Tinseltown. He's out in the West Coast. And that, of course, opens things up for Toronto, but it helps that they have Kawhi Leonard on their team. This is, I don't know how you feel about this as a Bucks fan, Cody, but this is kind of a classic series. Bucks go up 2-0. Game three, they're so close to putting the nail in the coffin. It's not the final nail, but you put that in if you go up 3-0. They can't quite finish it in regulation. They can't quite finish it at the end of the first overtime. Actually, Kawhi struggled in this game three in the second half. He was 4-for-14 from the floor. And in that second overtime, 3-for-3, three big buckets, puts it away. Raptors come back to make it 2-1. I think this was also the game they switched Kawhi onto Giannis as a more primary assignment defensively, although I've done an entire video in the past on how this was a great team effort and scheme effort from Nick Nurse. Nick Nurse is a rookie coach here. Game four, big game for Kyle Lowry out of the gate, big win for the Raptors. Game five is just a classic battle. I mean, Fred Van Vliet is doing Fred Van Vliet-y things. We're back in Milwaukee. It's a super close, intense game. Raptors pull it out at the end with some big plays. And then they advance to the finals in game six.
So this obviously hurts. This series hurts a little bit, right? But it also holds a special place in my heart because this is the first and only playoff game I attended. I was there at the top of the Fiserv Forum for game one of this series that ended in a very close Bucks win. And that was pretty cool. But ultimately, the first thing that I think about whenever I think about this series, Ben, is Fred Van Vliet having a child. Right. Coming back.
That's not fair. That should not be allowed. You should not be allowed to enter fatherhood during the playoffs. It clearly, gives you superpowers beyond what we should be able to control.
It's unbelievable. He comes back and he doesn't miss. I'm convinced he didn't miss a three-pointer for the rest of the season. I don't remember exactly what it was, but
he was only 16-28 in this series from downtown.
So in the semifinals, in the series before this, Van Vliet averaged 4.4 points per 75 on -32 efficiency. For this series, jumps up to 14 on +11 against the Bucks. So I don't know. It's Fred. It's Fred's award. I don't care what anyone else says.
You want to give it to Fred Van Vliet? I think the crazy stat in this series, just a crazy stat. That game three, that double overtime, semi-classic game where the Bucks can't put that nail in the coffin, the Raptors come back and win. One of those games where it's like the Red Sox and the Yankees in 2004, you're down 3-0, just get one on the board. Just get one on the board, and you can roll downhill from there, and that's what happened. Giannis Antetokounmpo in that game, do you remember how many points he had in that game?
I don't. No.
Giannis had 12 points in that game, and he played 45 minutes, which back then for Giannis and Coach Bud in a double overtime game was a lot. I hope it would be more today, but that stat just blew me away because I am pretty familiar with that game, especially from doing some video work on that series, and I was like, I just don't think you'd ever see that stat line again anymore from Giannis. 5-for-16, 0-for-3 from downtown, 2-for-7 from the free throw line, 12 points and 23 rebounds in that game 3 loss.
That's a really tough one. The context improves then when Bledsoe leaves, because during the series too, Bledsoe shoots, 17% from 3 on 39% true shooting. Just the Raptors can completely load up and not worry about him and load up the paint. And I think at this point, a key part of Giannis is this is not the Giannis that we've seen the last couple of years. He's, especially I thought in 2022, and I think it really started to come fruition in the finals of 2021, he adds a lot more variability to his offense. He's able to hit you with the post fade. He has a hook shot. He's much more patient. I think this is almost a bigger key, is he's much more patient with his passing reads. And in 2019, when you just throw all of these bodies at you, you reference Kawhi Leonard, and I think you bring up in the video, and something that I noticed too, Pascal Siakam might have done an even better job as a one-on-one defender against Giannis with his length and bothering him, but Marc Gasol being as big as they were, I don't know. Giannis just didn't quite have the offensive repertoire yet to handle this sort of multi-layered defense.
They were a great defense, which is, you know, anytime you encounter a great defense, you look at a series like this, it's not going to be a LeBron slam dunk like we've seen. It was a close series, very competitive, close 6-game series. I believe it was a 1-point scoring margin, plus 1-point scoring margin. And then here's another crazy stat from this series. In a losing effort, Malcolm Brogdon was the individual, the starter, with the highest net rating. Of course, he played on the losing Bucks. And Cody, you want to take a guess at what his the Bucks net rating was when Brogdon was on the court in this series?
Man, if it was a plus one overall, let's say it's like a plus 6.
Yeah, I think that's a good guess. It was plus 11.
Oh, wow.
They were somehow plus 11 with Brogdon on the court. So with that said, leading scorer in the series was Kawhi Leonard at 30 points per game. He did play really nice man defense, used his strength very well against Giannis. He leads in a number of the all-in-one metrics as well. So for me, the 2019 Thinking Bird goes to Kawhi Leonard.
Yeah, I think it's the right decision.
The Discord, let's see if the Discord agrees. They have it as Kawhi Leonard as well. Giannis picks up 2 votes, and Kyle Lowry gets a vote. I was looking at Lowry because, you know, he had some moments in this series as well, so I guess that makes some sense. Kawhi Leonard, 2019 winner.
I'm at least a little disappointed that Freddie didn't pick up a vote. Freddie All-NBA didn't pick up a vote.
Now we get to the, just like we did in the Western Conference, we get to the very, very, very easy to decide. Nothing is strange about this at all. It's totally normal to look back on post-pandemic basketball. The first series is the 2020 series in the bubble between the Heat and, once again, the Celtics. Man, Jason Tatum is just like a staple in the Eastern Conference Finals. This series was another one of these like really, really close 6-game series between the Heat and the Celtics. Heat end up winning it. They go up 3-1. They end up losing game 5, holding on to win game 6. Remember what was so weird about the bubble is there's no home court advantage. So you like get up and there's no dynamic of stealing serve on the road or going back home to change the dynamic of the series. It's just very strange looking back.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff going on with the shooting variance and the home court advantage, and it's still hard to go back and like figure out exactly what to take away from that season, but that was an odd time.
The point differential in this series, I mentioned it was a close series between the two teams. Did I say this already? We've been recording for so long, I can't remember what ground I've already covered.
I don't think so. I don't think I heard a net rating at this point.
Okay. The point differential in this series, the Celtics actually outscored the Heat by 0.2 points per game. So it was a very close series. Miami won game one, 117-114. So they took that close game. They won game two, 106-101. They took that close game. And they won game four, 112-109. They took that close game. The other three games were a little larger in terms of margin of victory, but it was a very close series. And when you keep winning those close games, when Goran Dragic, Jimmy Butler, Bam Adebayo, when they keep making the key plays down the stretch against the young Celtics, it's really hard historically, Cody, to lose three close games. It's almost impossible to lose three close games and win a series.
Yeah, and you know, when I was trying to rewatch, I was trying to pick out the players that were really standing out to me. And I think it only comes down to a couple of players here. And the one player that I really focused on when I was watching was Bam Adebayo. Because I feel like a key element of the way that Miami was playing was their defensive coverage against the Celtics. And I think it was Gibson Piper has a video about this, breaking down how I think the Heat ran about 30 possessions of zone in a couple of the games against the Celtics, and the Celtics really struggled against this zone. They didn't quite know how to pick it apart, and that was, I think Bam is kind of the skeleton key that goes into unlocking that, because he's so flexible defensively. And when we talk about like specific moments, you know, Jason Tatum had the dunk back in 2018?
2018.
Yeah, 2018, yep. Against LeBron. He tries it again. Bam meets him at the rim for just the one of the all-time rejections.
This is the one where his wrist like bends as the ball comes over the rim, but his wrist strength is enough that he can keep, you know, it doesn't break. It looks like it's going to break, but he spits the ball back out.
It's echoes of the Roy Hibbert block and the Carmelo Anthony dunk. I think 2013, 2012, he had a very similar dunk where his wrist is like bending around the rim. But I don't know. I don't know what to think about Bam, because he was also not great at self-generating points. But when it came to their offense, he was generating easy points as being a role man and just kind of being by the rim and grabbing offensive rebounds. But Jason Tatum, man, Jason Tatum was really showing up in this series. So to me, it came down to those two guys.
Interesting. It came down to the same two guys for me as well. This was sort of in 2020, right before the shutdown, we're starting to see, I thought, the ascendance of Tatum into that superstar tier of players. He ended up with, in this series, 24 points per 75, minus two efficiency. Wasn't like his greatest passing series or anything like that, but led the Celtics at 27 points per game, 10 rebounds, 6 assists. I just thought, you know, I'm with you, Cody, on Bam not being a primary weapon. The thing is, in this series, he was a little bit more, especially because of the matchup with Daniel Theis. And I just didn't think the Celtics had an answer for him in the big man position. He really bullied him at times. He gave him the full Bam that we've been. I mean, this is what we allude to when we talk about the full Bam treatment. And he just had these dominant moments on offense and on defense. You know, he was critical, as you mentioned, to the way the defense hummed. And then offensively, he actually ended up leading the Heat in scoring in this series, 22 points per game. And then because he was able to have this mismatch, apply pressure, and remember all that movement. I did a video on the Miami movement as well, and Bam's passing from the elbow area as a feeder there. He also led them in assists in this series at 5.2 assists per game. So to me, it was actually enough offensively combined with the defense to go with Adebayo here. He led the series in Basketball References box plus minus model. He led the series in our box plus minus model. He led the series in ScoreVal. Close series, I could definitely see going with the Celtic, but I think Bam Adebayo, especially when I think about this series, he's the guy that jumps out.
And Jimmy Butler didn't quite have the juice that he brought in the next series or some of the other big Jimmy Butler series we've seen, like this last year. We also had like a couple of good, just solid offensive outputs. We had Goran Dragic, who was, you know, Kemba Walker was really a defensive liability at the time. Dragic was able to target him. We had the famous 37-point Tyler Hero performance in Game 4 when everyone vaulted him into the, is Tyler Hero like a top 30 guy in the NBA right now? But it wasn't quite enough. They had enough offensive juice to go around everyone else that I think Bam's ability, like you said, to almost be like a passing hub and be a play finisher, and then obviously like the defensive skeleton key that he probably gets it in my book.
Yep, there was a lot of balance on the offense, which helped. If we go to the disc, I've actually never looked at this. Let's see what the Discord voted. The Discord has Jason Tatum with one vote. Jimmy Butler gets 6 votes. Bam Adebayo wins it again, 17 votes from them. And that leaves us with one final series. I know you're going to have nothing to say about this. This is the 2021 Bucks and the Hawks. And right away, I mean, we are still feeling this sort of post-pandemic weird basketball. Fans are just coming back. Everybody and their mother is getting COVID. And in this case, Giannis Antetokounmpo misses the last two games of this series with a hyperextended knee. I believe that was the injury. So he's the leading point per game scorer for the Bucks at 27 points per game. The Bucks, of course, win this series in 6 over the Hawks. It was tied 2-2 when Giannis went down. And then Milwaukee, you know, it gets very dicey when you don't have Giannis for those two games. Milwaukee went on to win game 5 by 11 at home, and then a big push at the end, really the third quarter in game 6 to take it and go to the finals. Giannis leads the team 27 points per game, but because he missed some games, Chris Middleton ends up being the leading scorer in the series. He averages 24 points per game on 7 assists. Holiday averages 22 points per game on 10 assists. Trae Young finishes at 28 points per game and 7 assists. What did you do here, Cody? I mean, this is another mess.
Yeah, first of all, going back to that Giannis injury, as a Bucks fan, I called it after this. I was like, you know what? This has been a great run. Whatever happens, happens. I have no idea how this man came back and played in the finals. Like, if you watch that, this is not just like a simple little knee hyperextension. That looked pretty nasty at the time, and I thought he was done. So, yeah, philosophically, it's interesting. Does Giannis in those 4 games have enough? To me, the guy that really was standing out in Giannis's stead was Jrue Holiday. And we talk a lot about like funky players that are able to dominate in their own special ways. And to me, this epitomized what Jrue Holiday was bringing to the Bucks, because I thought, you know, he was slicing his way into the paint. He's got such an interesting driving style because he's not the quickest guy. He's pretty built. He's a strong dude. You're talking about thick legs. This is a very thick-legged defensive player. But, you know, he was able to slice in there, finish with his left hand, post up, hit some little, like, post fades and things like that. His switching ability, he could go from Trae Young. He switched on to John Collins a few times, and I thought that was key for what they were doing defensively. And ultimately, like, yeah, Chris Middleton obviously picked up a lot of the scoring punch, but Jrue Holiday picked up, I think, more of the playmaking ability, and I think his defense was more vital to what the Bucks were doing.
If there were no other good players in this series, I think Giannis's 4 games would be enough for me. We talked about this last time, missing a game, and it kind of turns into a replacement bad game for the player and things like that. But the thing is, as you're talking about, there were other good players in this series. The Bucks were +8 with Jrue Holiday on the court in this series. He had a +4 augmented plus-minus per game, which is very good. That's like good all-NBA level basketball. +5 in box plus-minus. He had a good offensive series. Then you add to that the defense on Trae Young and how critical he is at the point of attack. Then you have Chris Middleton doing Chris Middleton things in this series. He struggles shooting to start the series, has a huge bounce back game in game 3, 38 points, 7 assists on 71% true shooting. Meanwhile, in that game, we just get a classic Jrue Holiday game, 2 for 11, 24% true shooting, but I think he had 12 assists in that game. He was playmaking. He was defending against Trae. It's just the Bucks win that game by 11. Game 4, Giannis gets injured in that game. That's the game where it goes to 2-2. And then you end up in the last couple games, as you said, I just thought so much playmaking from Jrue Holiday. 4 Bucks over 20 points. Brooke Lopez has that crazy 33-point game in game 5. And then in game 6, Chris Middleton with a 23-point third quarter as part of that huge run. But Jrue Holiday also had a huge second half. So this was a tough one for me. It kind of came down to Jrue or Chris. I think they both had enough value to eclipse 4 games of Giannis, or 3 3/4 games of Giannis, whatever it turned out to be. I'm going to go Jrue Holiday here for the 2021 Eastern Conference Finals MVP.
I think that's the right decision. And even when you were bringing him up, like Brook Lopez, that 33-point explosion, but also just like, again, the bedrock of their dropping defense. And Brook Lopez is such a good drop defender, just such a good drop defender. And he had so much more of a load without Giannis. But again, I thought what Holiday did to step up in multiple areas was a little bit more valuable than what anyone else brought up.
We have a disagreement. The Discord only gave Drew Holiday 6 votes. Mm-hmm. They gave Chris Middleton 0 votes. They gave Trae Young 0 votes. They gave the rest of the votes to Giannis Antetokounmpo, who was their choice for Finals MVP. But that's okay. They can be wrong every once in a while.
You know, as long as it's not like a J.R. Smith vote, I'll accept it. It's okay with me in my book.
So that now that we've done about 800 MVPs, let's look back, because I was trying to count. I think that's, we had 2 last time and 8 in a row today, which gives LeBron James 10 conference finals MVPs, and they were all Thinking Birds, right? LeBron has 10.
Yep, because he did not get a Thinking Johnson, because Anthony Davis got it over him in 2020.
Yes, we gave Anthony Davis our Thinking Johnson. Curry had 5. Remember, he won 5 in a row. So LeBron eclipsed that with whatever happened. We lost Cody on that one. He's down for the count. He's actually faded out of the picture if you're watching this video. Kobe had 4, including 3 in a row. And then we had some other multiple winners. Most of these were in the West. Shaquille O'Neal 2 times. Jason Kidd twice. Dwayne Wade twice. Kevin Garnett 1 in each conference. Dirk Nowitzki twice. And Tim Duncan twice. Those were all our multiple winners of either a Thinking Bird or a Thinking Johnson for conference finals MVPs since the year 2000. Anything else you want to add on this, Cody?
I'll be honest, Ben, I missed about 20 seconds of that. I was in the astral plane somewhere for a second. You just went over the multi-time winners.
The multi-time winners. Oh, I remember. You were going to maybe discuss the winners of the double and the winners of the trifecta.
See, this is the thing. We didn't come up with a great name for either of them, did we yet?
No. We did not. That's our working title, and you never want to go to press with your working title. But we were looking at players who had won now both a conference finals MVP and a finals MVP in the same season. Maybe that can at least approximate something close to what we'd think of as a playoff MVP. And then the trifecta would be regular season MVP, conference finals MVP, finals MVP.
Yeah, so in the West, the double winners, the ones that won both the conference finals MVP and the finals MVP, we have Shaq in 2002. We have Kobe in 2009 and Kobe in 2010. We have Dirk Nowitzki in 2011. So we have 3 in a row that get the double crown in 2009 to 2011. And then Steph Curry in 2022, even though that was in our awards, he did end up with that double crown. In the East, we have not quite as many. In 2006, Dwayne Wade wins both the conference finals MVP and the finals MVP. 2016, LeBron does it. And then 2019, Kawhi Leonard does it again. And then, Ben, we have the triple winners, the ones that sweep the award, that both get, or triple, that get conference finals MVP, finals MVP, and regular season MVP.
Oh, wow.
And those are Shaq in 2000 did it. Tim Duncan in 2003 did it.
Okay, so we're only like only mega seasons so far.
Only mega seasons. And then it only happens 2 more times. 2012 and 2013, LeBron does it 2 years in a row. LeBron ends up winning this award. So that happens quite less frequently than the other, but we have a few that were able to get the conference finals and finals MVP.
Man, those are like 3 of the greatest peaks. All 3 of those very high in my greatest peak series, or on typical like historical peaks projects, you'll see those names right at the top. And now it makes me wonder, if we went back in time, would we also see other mega years? Would we see 1991 Michael Jordan? Would we see 1987 Magic Johnson? Would we see 1986 Larry Bird? My hunch is yes. And now it's kind of making me a little sad that we might not have this historically. We've had a lot of fun and games for the last 7 hours recording and going back and reliving these series and handing out these imaginary awards, which should become official. If we have, we're going to put a little petition into the league office. But it's interesting to just, I didn't think about this before we started this project, going back and noting the only seasons since 2000 that have done that are the Shaq 2000 MVP mega peak, Tim Duncan 2003 mega peak, and LeBron James 2012-2013. Just really, really interesting stuff.
I think it's, if we were to go back, I don't remember off the top of my head, are there any years where you gave a finals MVP to Steph Curry where he would end up with more of these?
Correct. Yeah, there are. I think Steph Curry is the 2015 finals MVP.
That would give him a triple crown.
That would be one, and that would essentially fold in the years for his peak, which is also a top. I think I had him seventh or something like that. Also a top 10 peak in that series. 2019, I like him, but what would that do?
No, because Giannis got regular season MVP, but that would give him a two. Yeah. He would have a two.
That would give him a double. Yeah. And as of now, the only double he has is 2022, which is, you know, in a way, why we're seeing sort of a narrative bounce back or a retrofitting of the things that have happened in the last 5 or 6 years with him, because it's the first time. The thing about this that stands out is when you punch your ticket with a strong conference finals MVP, and then you sort of close it, you put the icing on the cake with a finals MVP, it does a lot for your narrative standing. It leaves an incredible taste in people's mouths for the summer, and it just really boosts you historically. We saw this with Dirk Nowitzki in his 2011 run as well.
Yeah, and like you said, it's a good heuristic to go back and be like, oh, the only people that pulled off, you know, three in a row or three in the same season are probably the best seasons of all time. And, you know, I hope maybe in future off seasons we're able to explore this more, because I'd be interested to see it.
Goodness knows we've watched enough conference finals from the 80s and 90s this summer to do that. I will say, since you brought it up, I think, I don't remember if I officially switched it, but Wade was my possible 2011 finals MVP. So my personal picks might be a little different, but you would definitely end up with this sort of holy trinity that we're landing on, which is like Shaq gets all the MVPs in 2000. Duncan gets them all in 2003. LeBron gets them all in 2013. Michael Jordan probably gets them all in 1991, et cetera, et cetera. Cody, any final parting thoughts before we put what do you put at the end of something? A period. A punctuation.
No, this was fun. This is a lot of fun. I liked this series, and you know, I think the league should adopt these as the official winners.
Hopefully, yes. Well, send your petition to the league. I was going to say head over to Patreon, but first send your petition to the league to adopt the official Thinking Johnsons and Thinking Birds as these historical winners. We can send this right to Cooperstown. I mean, Springfield. This is got my Hall of Fames mixed up. You know, we've been recording for too long. What was I even saying? You know what helps? If you like this and you thought it was a lot of fun, leave a rating and a review wherever you listen to podcasts. Otherwise, you can directly support us at patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. Not only will we have additional content, but all the stats we reference throughout this series, all those series by series stats for every player. I think Cody said there's over 4,000 player seasons going back to 2001. Those are all available, along with a number of other historical stats. patreon.com/thinkingbasketball. For Cody, thanks as always for listening all the way through. Hope you enjoyed it with us. And then, of course, wherever you are listening from out there in the world, you are having a great day.